Welcome to the serialized short story audiobook collection, Bones Are White, by Scott Sigler. Get the stories in Bones Are White for all ebook readers at scottsigler.com/bonesarewhite, or from that same page as a full-length audiobook. You can also buy the ebook version directly from the Kindle Store, the Nook Store, Apple's iBooks, and from Google Play. This book contains harsh language, adult situations, and lots of violence. So if you're easily offended, cue up some Taylor Swift and enjoy.
Passenger. January 12th, 2554. Sergeant Marcus Crowley's legs kept pumping, pushing him toward the top of the ridge. In 6 years of combat, he'd never been this terrified. Bullets sang off rocks all around him, kicking up stone splinters that found their way between his armor plates, through his armor fiber suit. The rock shards stung like rat bites, but they didn't stop him. Nothing could stop him. No one could stop him. Least of all, Marcus Crowley himself. Sweat poured from his skin in a failing effort to cool the heat generated by the noonday sun and his endless running. His new commanders wanted to complete missions. They didn't seem to care about the limitations of human anatomy. His body rolled over the ridge and slid down the other side. His feet planted themselves in the crumbling dirt and rock, stopping his momentum. His hands scrambled at his chest webbing, pulling out a grenade, twisting the timer, throwing it back down the ridge, pulling out another, twisting it, throwing it back down the ridge. On the other side of the ridge, the grenades detonated. The explosions must have been huge. Aside from the ear-rending blast, the concussive force literally moved the mountain underneath him. The first blast popped him off the surface like a card slapped from a table by a frustrated poker player. Less than half a second later, the second blast rocked the surface, smacking him in midair. He'd been hit before, so many times, but he'd never experienced anything like being punched by a fucking mountain. Marcus lost consciousness. Earlier that same day, Marcus Crowley and his 6th Recon squad mates from the 107th Marine Regiment, Recon Bulldogs, hoorah, downtripped from the cruiser Josh Carter to the surface of Vozor 7. Marcus had seen dawn on 5 planets, but nothing like V7. The soupy atmosphere barely supported human life. His squad's armed orbital vehicle cut through that atmosphere, heading for the surface. He stared out through his gun mount's tiny viewport. A rising sun touched the dawn sky, lighting it up like iridescent rubies swirled with yellow flashes of burning golden air. Johnny Chesk had told him about the atmosphere's chemical composition before they left the Josh Carter. But Marcus didn't remember and didn't really give a fuck. It wasn't just the ruby and gold sky that made V7 look so cool. Strange, rubbery blue trees covered most of the surface. Those trees made for a recon trooper's dream. Dense foliage to hide in. Plant material soft, so it made little noise even when underfoot. And plants that didn't burn for crap. Recon could hide in that shit for days. They couldn't even be smoked out. Vozor 7 operated as a military research outpost. It was in the same system as Vozor 3, but the two planets were so different, they might as well have orbited different suns. V3 held some 79 million Planetary Union citizens. V7, on the other hand, struggled to support a population of less than 10 million. If the military-industrial complex ever went away, V7's population would probably drop to 5 million or less. Marcus's very first downtrip had been on this very planet. He'd done boot here. Training how to ride a bucket of bolts from low orbit down to the surface was the first challenge any Union soldier faced. If you couldn't handle a down trip, you couldn't be infantry, let alone move up the ladder into special forces. Marine boot, then a year of advanced training, two combat missions as infantry, then recon school, another year of training. At 26 years old, Marcus had spent more time on V7 than he'd spent in any other place. He'd met his first husband here, spent 6 months happier than a pig in shit until Demetrius died in, ironically, a down-trip accident. He'd lived here, loved here, found his calling here. If Marcus could call anywhere in the galaxy home, V7 was it. So, he'd down-tripped to V7 more times than he could count. Only this time, he wasn't down-tripping for training or R&R. He was here to fight. Fight his own people. This sudden rebellion had erupted 2 days earlier. Mutineers had seized the James Malik research base just south of the equator. If any demands had been made, Marcus certainly wasn't privy to them. He'd heard plenty of rumors, but all he knew for certain was that his unit had been deployed for combat. Really? That was the only thing that mattered. Command would tell him which way to point his L-62. Marcus breathed slowly as their AOV dropped below 500 meters. He took his right hand off the top gun controls, reached down, and ran his fingertips along the L-62's familiar shape. There were many like it, but that one was his. If luck held, soon he'd be out of this bucket and have the L-62 in his hands. In flight, he couldn't protect his people. They were headed into a hot LZ, sure, but up here, he couldn't do anything but wait. On the ground, a recon boy can survive. Marcus put his hands back on the top gun controls. There was never anything to shoot at on a down trip, but he did it anyway. Johnny Chesk manned the bottom gun. Cheryl Everson flew the bucket, while Jay Crossler and Dan Psycho Hudson manned the side cannons. Stephen the Duck Middleton rode in the AOV's dead center, mine linked into both the ECM suite and the fleet net. On a down trip, Duck didn't say much to his squad mates. He was probably busy having 15 or 20 simultaneous conversations with Air Command, AI systems, and low-level net traffic. Marcus, Johnny, Cheryl, Crossler, and Duck made up the active AOV crew. The rest of the squad, Sforza, Philbrick, Wynn, and Jennings, sat strapped in tight to narrow flight chairs, counting the moments until they could get out of this flying coffin and know the reassurance of boots on the ground. The Union admirals, apparently, were none too happy that Malik Base had gone rogue. Rumor was the brass had received panicked reports of a violent mutiny, of military and civilian staff alike being slaughtered. Those reports slowed as the first day wore on. By the second day, the reports stopped altogether. Rapid reaction forces, a company from V3's Defense Brigade, swept in. The Malik base guns took them out before they even reached orbit. All the defenses set up to stop Sklorno raids worked just as well against Planetary Union assault ships. Losing three assault ships and nearly 300 soldiers and crew had been enough for the admirals. They'd dropped a 1 kiloton nuke on Malik. No fucking around. No negotiations. No more wasted troops. Word was that there was some serious next-gen tech going on at Malik, and the Gold Caps didn't care to see if these mutineers could get that tech to work. Less than 5 hours after the nuke hit, E-troopers downtripped to take control of the area. It amazed Marcus that people thought he and his fellow recon soldiers were crazy. Compared to E-Troopers, Marcus was as sane gets. Who volunteers to downtrip into a goddamn nuke site? Environmental troopers needed rad suits, rad meds, rad-fighting nanosites, and all kinds of things designed to keep their bodies from cooking alive. And, on top of that, they still had to fight any other rad-protected forces vying for control. Usually, those enemy forces were Sklorno E-Troopers. But more and more, outlying conflict skirmishes pitted the E-Troopers against Quith warriors. It was a disturbing trend. Sklorno and Union alike weren't shy about using tactical nukes. And where there were nuke craters, there were Quith. The Quith weren't even in this damn war, yet they showed up in conflict zones. The Quith claimed neutrality, saying that they were non-combatants on scientific exploration missions. Maybe they were neutral, but they were also armed. When threatened or attacked, Quith fought back. They didn't seem to need the bulky rad suits either. And damn if they weren't ugly fuckers. But hey, at least it wasn't like fighting the Key. So the Union E-Troopers had landed at Malak Base, secured the site, then set up the self-assembling radicite factories. Radicites would gobble up that radiation. Within a week, the Malak site would be rad-free and ready for reconstruction. Hopefully, that would happen before a Quith team showed up. With the crater that had been Malak Base secured, the E-Troopers had moved out to increase their perimeter. This much Marcus had on good knowledge, from a friend who worked on the bridge of the Josh Carter. At the edges of the rad zone, the E-Troopers stopped reporting. There were some screams, a lot of, "What the fuck is that?" Then nothing. After that came the really disturbing shit. Reports of E-Troopers firing on each other. Marcus didn't believe that, not for one second. Those guys were like the Spartans of ancient Earth. They served 10-year tours of duty, lived together on the same ship, ate together, and fought together. E-Troopers were a different breed. They struck Marcus as the kind of people who would gut their own mother with a rusty knife before ever attacking one of their own. Once the entire division of E-Troopers stopped reporting in, the Gold Caps ordered the 4th Flotilla into orbit around V7, blockading all traffic in and out. The Admiralty quarantined an entire planet. They didn't know what was going on down there. To get that information, they decided to drop in the 107th. "Landing zone locked," Duck said. "Clear path to grid 1625. Marcus's jawbone implant let him hear Duck as if the guy were standing 2 feet away. Cheryl sounded almost as close. "Roger, grid 1625, she said. "Duck, what's the haps on hostiles?" Cheryl sounded nervous, and with good reason. The downtrip was a recon trooper's worst time, period. With feet on the ground, if shit got hot, you could run away, you could hide. Every recon soldier's training included the ability to cram himself or herself into less than a cubic meter of space and stay there, unmoving, for days. That skill was part training, part discipline, and part backlink aug. Program the BA to lower your heart rate. Set your brain waves into a hibernating state, and your respiration slowed to the point where you damn near stopped breathing altogether. The BA monitored low-level communications. It woke you up again if friendly troops were near or if you received shielded atmospheric comms from the Gold Caps. Recon only felt at home on the ground. Recon knew how to forage, how to talk without making a sound. how to find each other no matter how bad things got. Recon knew how to make bows and spears. Recon knew how to prepare the meat of all the known races, humans included. If you couldn't do any of those things, you didn't graduate from special ops school. The parachute pin was a badge that said you were a cut above, that you could carry on no matter what kind of ground was under your feet. In an armed orbital vehicle, however, you and your 9 closest buddies were meat-packed into a flying can. You might never even see it or hear it coming. One second, you're in a perfectly good bucket. The next, your backlink AUG registers your death and starts processing the next of kin notification. And an AOV is so easy to hit, so big. Not by fleet standards, of course. But when you can cram yourself into a half-meter cubic space and hide for a week, any ship that holds 10 people and their supplies looks like exactly what it is. A target so big you couldn't miss it if you tried. Marcus wanted out of the AOV, wanted it bad. But all he and his squad mates could do was wait for Cheryl to land the bucket. Until then, she and Duck were the only thing between the squad and death. "No enemy activity," Duck said. "First wave air armor experienced some small arms fire, but they eliminated the threat. I read AOVs from squads 1 through 5, 7 through 9 spreading out across the grid. 0 fire reported."
"Roger that," Cheryl said, "dropping to 150 meters.
Marcus heard Jay Crossler mumbling in complaint. Jay was midship, by the port hull, below and to Marcus's right. The jawbone implant made it sound like Jay was a foot away from Marcus's ear. J-plants helped orient to a speaker's location and direction, even when the speaker was beyond line of sight.
"Crossler," Marcus said, "you have something to share?"
"Just a request, sir," he said. "Cheryl, would you get this behemoth on the ground? I feel like I've got a big bullseye painted on my ass."
"Shut up, Crossler," Cheryl said. "You don't mind if I put Recon 6 where I was told to put it, do you?" If Marcus closed his eyes, Cheryl's voice sounded close enough for him to lean forward and kiss her. Not that he would. Or had recently, anyway. Cheryl could snipe a man from 1,000 meters and was bad news up close with a blade. But that didn't change the fact that she had a hot-as-hell body and could fuck like a minx. Marcus remembered that curve at the small of Cheryl's back, the way her skin looked in the moonlight. He didn't swing that way often, but when he did, he preferred a soldier like Cheryl. He shook his head to clear the thoughts. There would be time for that later, if they both lived. She banked the AOV left and dropped to 50 meters. Marcus reminded himself to breathe. They'd be on the ground and clear of the ship in less than 30 seconds.
"Hostile fire reported," Duck said, calm as you please. "Recon 4 hit by surface-to-air missiles." "Shit," Cheryl said.
"Here we go, boys!"
She screamed it more than said it, but the J-plant automatically compensated for the volume burst. Cheryl Everson wasn't the best pilot in the Marines, and she knew it.
"Duck, intel! What are they using?"
"Recon 4 going down," Duck said. "Recon 2 destroyed."
"What are they using?"
"Interpo says Manpack SAMs," Duck said. "There were 27 units in storage at Malak."
Portable surface-to-air missiles. Bad news, two ways. The first way was the most pressing. One soldier armed with a Manpack SAM could take out an entire AOV. As thick as the forest was, the AOV's sensors wouldn't pick up a thing until it was too late. The second way wasn't much better. It meant that the mutineers had probably cleaned out Malak Base's arms stores before the nuke hit. Whoever we were fighting, they would be well armed. Marcus didn't want to wait for a Sam to come up and say howdy.
Everson, he said, put us down. Don't wait for it.
We have a landing grid, Sarge, she said. 45 seconds and we're there.
We've been radar locked, Duck said, still calm as all fucking get out.
Everson, now, Marcus said. That's an order.
Aye, sir, she said.
Marcus felt the sweat start creeping along his skin. If a missile connected, he'd be lucky if he'd live long enough to die when the flaming AOV smashed into ground. He looked at his gun displays, seeking a target. It gave him something to do. He was on the top gun, so he wouldn't see jack shit unless fighter units came out to meet them. Live or die, now it was all up to Cheryl.
Talk to me, Duck, she said. Where's that lock coming from?
15 degrees off nose, Duck said. Alert, we have been locked by a second radar, 37 degrees off nose.
Heading for ground, Cheryl said. Squad, prep for emergency bounce down, hard landing, and immediate evac.
Recon one hit, Duck said. 3 casualties going down. Enemy striking with a coordinated attack across entire landing grid. Missiles fired at us. Repeat, missiles fired at us. 15 seconds to impact. Cheryl's composure was fading fast.
Hold on, boys! Here we go!
The roar of the AOV's engines suddenly stopped. Marcus felt his stomach rise up into his chest as they dropped like a rock. Cheryl was going for a bounce down. Cut the engines, let gravity do its thing. Fire up the VTOL blast 10 meters from the ground. When timed correctly, an AOV would land with all the impact of a beer coaster dropped on a bar. Cheryl didn't time it right. The AOV slammed into the ground hard enough to crack the frame. Marcus bit through his tongue. Blood filled his mouth. He paused for just 1 second, enough to reorient himself and grab his L-62 rifle out of its rack. He popped the top hatch and slid out down the AOV's side.
Evac! Now! Now! Now!
He sprinted away from the AOV. He wondered if the landing gear had held, or if Johnny Chesk was smashed below, an insect crushed under the AOV's big old footprint. The SAMs weren't going to stop because the bucket had hit dirt. Marcus and his squad had only seconds to get to a safe distance. There wasn't even time to grab anyone who might be wounded. Marcus hurtled undergrowth and sprinted around blue tree trunks. He counted to 10, then slid under a rubbery bush.
Marcus, clear.
Cheryl, clear,
he heard from the J-plant. She was somewhere on his right.
Sforza, clear.
And Philbrick, clear, he heard. But barely, as the first SAM hiss heralded a smoke trail snaking down at the AOV. Marcus hugged the ground. There wasn't much of an explosion. Most SAMs didn't kill by concussive force, but rather by plenamite marbles that shredded any material in their path. The expanding sphere of metal kicked up big clouds of dirt and sand, rattling the AOV as at least a dozen of them shredded through the bucket's armored hull.
Fack!
Crossler's voice.
Duck's dead!
Crossler, get out of there!
Marcus said. He didn't scream. He'd been through too many firefights for that. The J-plant always normalized volume, so scream or no scream, it all sounded the same to the guy on the other end.
Psycho clear.
Marcus saw it before he heard it. The second snaking trail of a SAM tracking its now grounded prey. The smoke trail arced through the air, pointing down and moving fast. He sat motionless and watched the missile descend.
Crossler clear.
2 seconds later, the SAM closed in.
Jennings,
the SAM exploded right above the AOV. Plenamite marbles blasted out, instantly punching 100-fist-sized holes in the bucket, shattering composite armor in a secondary spray of shrapnel. The AOV held its shape for a moment, then collapsed in on itself.
Medic!
It was Jennings. He hadn't been clear after all.
My fucking leg is gone.
His voice came from the left. He'd somehow exited on the wrong side of the AOV, against the standard deployment pattern.
Oh, fuck. My leg,
Jennings said.
Jennings, shut up, Marcus said. We'll get help to you, but shut your mouth and deal with it.
Marcus needed to know who was alive and ready to fight before he could help Jennings.
Chesk, Wynn, report.
Neither man answered. Sforza started talking, something he knew he shouldn't be doing.
How the fuck can our own guys shoot us down? He said.
Sforza sounded like he was farther away, probably on the far side of the destroyed AOV.
Sforza, shut it, Marcus said.
Chesk, Wynn, report!
Still nothing. Had they even made it clear? Marcus had to assume both men were dead.
Duck, Chesk, Wynn, dead.
Add in Jennings, a liability they'd have to deal with. And the squad's fighting strength now consisted of Marcus, Cheryl, Sforza, Psycho, Philbrick, and Crossler. Mathematically, Cheryl had done an amazing job. Under intense SAM fire, she'd managed to put the AOV down and keep casualties to 30%. That was the math. The reality was, they'd lost three friends. Four, if they didn't help Jennings fast.
Report injuries now, Marcus said. Not you, Jennings.
No one said a thing. He still had enough people to complete the mission. That's when the crossfire erupted.
You have been listening to the Bones Are White serialized short story audiobook, written by Scott Sigler. This audiobook was produced by A. Kovacs and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. For more information on the author or to hear his free weekly fiction podcast, go to scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song Greed by the band Separation of Sanity.
I am a creeping cancer, rots you to the core, pumping through your blackened heart, seduction of your soul, separation of your senses, sanity, your currency. I am your rolling gun, on your knees, kiss the screen.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.